Welcome to the Moth Podcast. I'm Amy Mullins, athlete, actor, moth storyteller, and your host for this episode. This summer in Paris, thousands of athletes will be running, swimming, throwing javelins, and surfing, skateboarding, and for the first time in Olympic history, breakdancing, or as the games call it, breaking. They'll be competing against their fellow Olympians and Paralympians, trying to win gold, yes, but more than that, they'll test themselves. They'll represent their countries. They'll make their loved ones proud. And they'll give it everything they've got on the world's biggest stage. And to celebrate this collective 4 weeks of momentous daring, on this episode of The Moth, we're sharing three stories, either about the games themselves or the feelings they inspire in us and the memories they create. These games certainly mean a lot to me. I had the honor of being named Chef de Mission, or chief of the mission, the de facto leader of Team USA for the London 2012 Games. And in 1996, I had the privilege to compete in the Paralympics in Atlanta, Georgia. Let me tell you, there's absolutely nothing like the experience of being an athlete chosen to represent your country. From the thrill of the opening ceremonies to bonding with the athletes in Olympic Village, dealing with the nerves right before your event's about to start, to the bittersweet ache of the closing ceremonies, the whole event is profoundly meaningful. The great American Olympian Evelyn Ashford once told me that you never put the word former next to the word Olympian. It's a club you belong to forever. The experience of joining that club completely altered the trajectory of my life in ways that can feel almost indescribable. Sometimes it just comes down to a feeling that percolates inside of you. Our first story is from someone who knows all about that feeling. Juliet Hawkman told this at a Portland, Oregon story slam. Here's Juliet, live at the Moth.
So my story starts about half of my lifetime ago. It's the summer of 1984, and I've just finished my junior year in high school. And my family's vacationing in a small town on the coast of Maine, and they all want to go out on the lobster boat for the afternoon to catch that night's dinner. But I don't want to go out on the lobster boat, because that afternoon, NBC is televising the Olympic final of the women's rowing 8 race. And I was a junior rower, and I wanted to watch these women row. So they all appeased my request, and we sat around this tiny 18-inch black and white television in this tiny inn and watched the race. And the women won. It was the first gold medal ever for women's rowing for the United States. And my dad quietly put his arm around me and said, "That's going to be you in 4 years." So fast forward almost 4 years, and I'm a junior at Harvard University. I'm rowing, I'm training, I'm working really hard, I'm studying Chinese, I'm holding down a part-time job. And this sounds really hard, but actually, when you wake up in the morning every morning and you have one thing in the world that you want to do more than anything else, and you have the steps laid out in front of you to do that, and all you have to do is execute, it's really easy. So I'm training and I'm rowing and I'm trying to get everything into a 24-hour day, and my parents are supporting me and they're making up jobs for me to do so I can earn money to pay for training. And I think one summer they said, "If you paint the barn, we'll give you $800. And I painted the barn, and I don't think it needed painting, but I had enough money for training for the next year. And all the time, both of them said to me, "We're so proud of you. We don't care how far you get. But whatever you do, make sure you ride this wave all the way into the beach." And so at the end of the time, however far you get in this crazy dream of yours, you know that there's nothing else you could have done to get there. But it was terrifying. You have this thing you want so badly. It's the only thing you're thinking about, and it completely consumes you. And I would lie awake at night, scared to death that I wasn't going to be able to do this thing, to make this Olympic team. Everyone was bigger. Everyone was older. I was the youngest by 2 years. I was the only one still in college training. It seemed impossible. So every single night, I would go to sleep thinking about the same thing. I would think about what it would be like to walk into the opening ceremonies in Seoul, South Korea on September 18th, 1988, in front of 100,000 people. And I saw it in my head every night for 500 nights leading into the summer of 1988. And I felt what it was like to be in that hot holding stadium with 10,000 athletes from 200 countries. And I could hear their languages and I could see their national dress. And I remembered, I could feel what it would feel like to walk into that cold tunnel that leads underneath the stadium and how the noise would kind of reverberate quietly. And then what it would be like to walk out onto the track in front of 100,000 people. And what that would, I could smell it and I could feel it and I could taste it. And that's how I fell asleep every night for 500 nights. So it's the summer of 1988. I make the team. I'm the youngest, I'm the smallest. I'm so excited, I make the priority boat. We get over to Seoul, Korea about a week before competition starts. And it comes to the night of the opening ceremonies. And it's exactly as I had always imagined it. There was the holding stadium with those 10,000 athletes in a million colors and a million languages. We were sweating like hell because it was so hot in our nasty JCPenney opening ceremony uniforms. It comes time for the opening ceremonies to start. We're shepherded into that tunnel. It's cold, it's dank. Our voices are kind of hushed and they're sort of reverberating off the cement walls. And then we burst out into this cacophony of noise and light and people screaming and we're crying and we're laughing. And this is, you know, the revolution will not be televised. This was pre-cell phone. No one was FaceTiming this live. We were in it. And as we walked around the track, I noticed that the organizing committee had organized the athletes' families according to national teams, so you could see the Italian flags and the French flags and the German flags and the South African, Chinese, all the way around. And three quarters of the way around the stadium, the greatest flag wavers on earth, the Americans, were there. It seemed like thousands of American flags. And as I made my way around the track with my American teammates, in a crowd of 100,000 people, as if they were the only ones in the stadium, I saw my parents. And I watched as my dad grabbed my mom's hand and raised it above their heads. And I could feel his arm around my shoulders just as he had been those 4 years early in that tiny town on the coast of Maine. And I realized in that minute that the biggest award of all is not the team that you might make or the podiums that you might stand on or the medals that might end up around your neck. The greatest award of all is understanding and appreciating and recognizing those people who support you unconditionally in achieving your dreams. Thank you.
That was Juliet Hawkman. After discovering what she calls the athlete 2.0 within herself, Juliet now helps others chase their dreams as a triathlon coach. Wow. Having become a world champion triathlete in her 50s. The mother of two grown sons, she lives in Oregon with her husband and frenetic black lab, and she loves her work. To see a photo of Juliet marching in the 1988 opening ceremonies, just visit our website at themoth.org/extras. You know, listening to Juliet's story makes me want to dig out the training mixtape a roommate made me. Yeah, I know I'm dating myself here, but it was the 90s. Getting a mixtape was one of the most heartfelt gifts you could receive back then because it took a lot of time to make. And this mixtape had those songs to get you through the toughest parts of your training regimen, for sure. But one entire section was kicked off by the Olympic fanfare and theme. That song that plays throughout the games with the trumpet sounding all regal and processional. You know the one I mean? I bet if I played you the first 4 seconds of that song, you could summon the rest by heart. Here you go. Take a listen. Right? I'm sure the rest of the song is running through your head right now. Anytime I hear that song, it still gets me so emotional because it's an instant memory transport to either being at the games myself or being a spectator watching these athletes on television step up onto that three-tiered podium as the medals were placed around their necks. Gets me every time. Fun fact, the Olympic fanfare and theme was composed by none other than the national treasure that is John Williams. Whether you're competing in the Olympics or just watching them on TV, there's this sense of togetherness that comes through. The sense that most of the world is focused on this one thing, and thankfully, it's not something tragic or awful. It's rigorous, but friendly competition. I mean, that's glorious. And not only do you root for your own country's athletes, but you discover the incredible stories of athletes from around the globe who surmounted overwhelming odds to be there. And you become invested in them too. Case in point, the Jamaican bobsled team, remember them? The athletes who become stars in the Olympics aren't made. They're revealed to us by what they do. The Olympic stars of my childhood had Americans like Jackie Joyner-Kersee and Mitch Gaylord, but also Katarina Witt from what was then East Germany, and the figure skating duo out of Great Britain that was Torvill and Dean. Look them up for some amazing hair and makeup looks. Up next is Mandy Hu to tell us a bit about her childhood memory of the Olympics and one Olympian in particular that she had a special connection with. She gave us this story at a Berkeley Story Slam. Here's Mandy, live at the Moth.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. The year is 1992. I'm an 11-year-old girl. I'm lying on my stomach on a carpet in a living room in Northern California in front of a giant ancient television. On the television is the Winter Olympics, the women's figure skating competition. It's the only event that matters because the other winter sports are preposterous. They're anonymous. I'm not going to root for a helmet careening down a mountainside. Give me instead the Soviet bloc judge or the flower collecting girls or the rinkside commentators. I love all of these accessories of figure skating because I love visible human faces. And in figure skating, they're often crying, which is great. But I'm lying on a carpet in a tan living room, in a tan house, in boring, crushingly boring, northern boring California. Next to me are not flag-waving fans, but Cool Ranch Doritos, kiwi strawberry soda, and a 12-ounce can of Niblets. Do you know what Niblets are? It's corn off the cob in a can, and it's delicious. So, anyway, I'm watching TV, and the figure skaters, they're slipping and sliding. Their edges catch, they fall, and then, they teach me lessons in physics through their personal pain. And then after their routines, they stand rinkside and they smudge mascara off their cheeks as their inky tears flow. And I love it. I love watching this. I'm spooning corn into my mouth and I'm watching this. But it's time. Finally, it is time for her. Behold, Christy Yamaguchi. Her unitard is as golden as her performance. Her hair is as long and black as a night without her highlight reel. Albertville, France, 1992. Christy Yamaguchi, in literal translation, mountain mouth. Yama means mountain and Gucci means mouth. Or the mouth that launched 1,000 ships. The mouth of my life. The mouth of my loins. The breathless post-skate interview showing off that prominent mouth mole and her coloratura soprano and her moist, ample teeth. I told you I love faces and hers is so good. Christy Yamaguchi, the stars are aligned. You're from the Bay Area just like me. Your slanty eyes and your sallow pallor are just like mine. So hard to find on television in 1992, even in the Bay Area where we are citizens of the world, because the world of television is still predominantly Aryan. Your wound up golden gams in midair as delicious as a hot sugar twist. In just 5 years, I will have my driver's license and I will drive my Volvo station wagon over the Dumbarton Bridge and rescue you from sulfuric Fremont. And then we'll live together forever in an ice palace filled with beds. We'll never have to leave, we'll just dehydrate and die happy. So I'm an 11-year-old girl. I'm feeling feelings that I didn't know I could feel. And I want to say things that I don't know how to say. So after the medal ceremony, I go to my diary. I get up off the carpet. I go to my diary and I write a letter to Christy Yamaguchi. Christy Yamaguchi, I wish you would marry some guy I know. Which I know, which the God that I still fear approves of. I mean, it's holy matrimony, it's bridal, it's conjugal, carnal marriage for Christy Yamaguchi and some guy I know. So Christy Yamaguchi, I wish you would marry some guy I know. But I'd write the S and the O in some and the guy I know in slightly smaller letters, so that God and I both know that what I'm actually trying to say is, Christy Yamaguchi, I wish you would marry me. This is when I start to worry that I might be gay. Thank you.
That was Mandy Hu. Mandy is a writer, a musician, and a union-side labor lawyer based in Berkeley. She wants you to know that in Disney's movie Frozen, ice is described as, quote, beautiful, powerful, dangerous, cold, unquote. And Mandy says she is essentially its antonym. The final story we'll be sharing is from me. I told this at a New York City main stage where the theme of the night was a more perfect union. Here I am, live at the Moth.
So 2 weeks ago, I was a bridesmaid, and the reception was actually here at the New York Public Library, and I will never forget this wedding. Yes, it was very beautiful, but more importantly, I survived the slick marble floors that are all over this building. Tile and marble floors are public enemy number one to a stiletto-loving girl like me. See, when most people learn to walk in very high heels, and I had 5-inch heels on that night, they bend their ankle so that the ball of the foot touches the ground first. You have more stability. I don't have ankles, so I hit each step on the stiletto, which makes the possibility of the banana peel wipeout very likely. But given the choice between practicality and theatricality, I say go big or go home, man. Go down in flames if you're going to go. I guess I'm a bit of a daredevil. I think that the nurses at DuPont Institute would agree. I spent a lot of time there as a child. Doctors amputated both of my legs below the knee when I was an infant, and then when I was 5, I had a major surgery to correct the wonky direction in which my tibia was growing. So I had 2 metal pins to hold that, full plaster casts on both legs. I had to use a wheelchair because I couldn't wear prosthetics. And one of the best things about getting out of the hospital is the anticipation of the day you return to school. You know, I had missed so much class. I just couldn't wait to get back and see all my friends. But my teacher had a different idea about that. She tried to prevent me from returning to class because she said that in the condition I was inappropriate, and that I would be a distraction to the other students, which of course I was, but not because of the cast and the wheelchair. Clearly, she needed to make my difference invisible because she wanted to control her environment and make it fit into her idea of what normal looked like. And it would have been a lot easier for me to fit into what normal looked like. I know I wanted that back then. But instead, I had these wooden legs with a rubber foot that the toes broke off of, and it was held on with a big rusty, you know, bolt that rusted out because I swam in the wooden legs, and you're not supposed to swim in the wooden legs, but, you know, the wood rots out too. So there you are in second grade music class doing the twist, and mid-twist, I hear this and I'm on the floor, and the lower half of my left leg is in splinters over there, and the teacher faints on the piano, and the kids are screaming. And all I'm thinking is, my parents are gonna kill me. I broke my leg. It's a mess. But then a few years later, my prosthetist tells me, Amy, we got waterproof legs for you. No more rusty bolts. I mean, this is a revelation, right? This is gonna change my life. I was so excited to get these legs until I saw them. They were made of polypropylene, which is that white plastic milk jug material. And when I say white, I'm not talking about skin color. I'm talking about the color. White. The skin color was the rubber foam foot painted Caucasian, which is the nastiest shade of a nuclear peach that you've ever seen in your life. It has nothing to do with any human skin tone on the planet. And these legs were so good at being waterproof that they were buoyant. So when I'd go off the high dive, I'd go down and come straight back up, feet first. They were the bane of my existence. But then at the Jersey Shore, one summer, you know, by the time we get there, there's like 300 yards of towels between me and the sea, and I know this is where I first honed my ability to run really fast. I was the white flash. I didn't want to feel hundreds of pairs of eyes staring at me. And so I get myself into the ocean, and you know, I was a good swimmer, but no amount of swimming technique can, you know, to control buoyant legs. So at some point I get caught in a rip current, and I'm migrating from my vantage point of where I could see my parents' towel, and I'm like, you know, taking in water, and I'm fighting, and all I could think to do was pop off these legs and put one under each armpit with the peach feet sticking up and just bob, like, just wait. It's like, someone's got to find me, you know? And a lifeguard did. And I'm sure he will collect for therapy bills. You know, you could see it, like, they don't show that on Baywatch. But they saved my life, those legs. And then when I was 14, it was Easter Sunday, and I was going to be wearing a dress that I had purchased with my own money for the first thing I ever bought that wasn't on sale. Momentous event, you never forget it. I had a paper route since I was 12, and I went to the Limited, and I bought this dress that I thought was the height of sophistication, sleeveless safari dress, belted, hits the knee. Coming downstairs to the living room, my father's waiting to take us to church. He takes one look at me and he says, "That doesn't look right. Go upstairs and change." I was like, "My super classy dress? What are you talking about? It's the best thing I own." He said, "No, you can see the knee joint when you walk. It doesn't look right. It's inappropriate to go out like that. Go change." And I think something snapped in me. I refused to change. And it was the first time I defied my father. I refused to hide something about myself that was true. And I refused to be embarrassed about something so that other people could feel more comfortable. And I was grounded for that defiance. And so after church, the extended family convenes at my grandmother's house, and everybody's complimenting me on how nice I look in this dress. And I'm like, "Really? You think I look nice? Because my parents think I look inappropriate." And I outed them. Kind of mean, really. But I think the public utterance of this idea that I should somehow hide myself was so shocking to hear that it changed their mind about why they were doing it. You know, I had always managed to get through life with somewhat of a positive attitude, but I think this was the start of me being able to accept myself. You know, okay, I'm not normal. I have strengths, I got weaknesses, it is what it is. And I had always been athletic, but it wasn't until college that I started this adventure in track and field. You know, I'd gone through a lifetime of being given legs that just barely got me by. And I thought, well, maybe I'm just having the wrong conversations with the wrong people. Maybe I need to go find people who say, "Yes, we can create anything for you in the space between where your leg ends and the ground." And so I started working with engineers, fashion designers, sculptors, Hollywood prosthetic makeup artists, wax museum designers to build legs for me. And I decided I wanted to be the fastest woman in the world on artificial legs. And I was lucky enough to arrive and track at just the right time to be the first person to get these radical sprinting legs modeled after the hind leg of a cheetah, the fastest thing that runs, woven carbon fiber. And I was able to set 3 world records with those legs, and they made no attempt at approximating humanness. But then I got these incredibly lifelike silicone legs, hand-painted, capillaries, veins. Hey, I can be as tall as I want to be, so I get different legs for different heights. I don't have to shave. I can wear open-toed shoes in the winter, and I can... Most importantly, I can opt out of the cankles I most certainly would have inherited genetically. So then I get these legs made for me by the late, great Alexander McQueen, and they were hand-carved of solid ash with grapevines and magnolias all over them, 6-inch heel. And I was able to walk runways of the world with supermodels. And I was suddenly in this whirlwind of adventure and excitement. And, you know, I was being invited to go around the world and speak about these adventures. And now I had, you know, legs that looked like glass, legs covered in feathers, porcelain legs, jellyfish legs, all wearable sculpture. And I get this call from a guy who had seen me speak years ago when I was at the beginning of my track career. And he says, "We loved it. We loved it. We want you to come back." And it was clear to me, he didn't know all these amazing things that had happened to me since my sports career. So as I'm telling him, he says, whoa. Hold on, Amy. The reason everybody liked you all those years ago was because you were this sweet, vulnerable, naive girl. And I'm afraid that if you walk on stage today and you are this polished young woman with too many accomplishments, for real, he said that, I'm afraid they won't like you. Wow. He apparently didn't think I was vulnerable enough now. He was asking me to be less than, a little more downtrodden. He was asking me to disable myself for him and his audience. And what was so shocking to me about that was that I realized I'd moved past mere acceptance of my difference. I was having fun with my difference. Thank God I'm not normal. I get to be extraordinary. And I'll decide what is a weakness and what might be a strength. And so I refused his request. And a few days later, I'm walking in downtown Manhattan at a street fair, and I get this tug on my shirt, and I look down, it's this little girl I had met a year earlier when she was at a pivotal moment in her life. She had been born with a brittle bone disease that resulted in her left leg being 7 centimeters shorter than her right. And she wore a brace and orthopedic shoes, and it got her by. But she wanted to do more. And like all internet-savvy kindergartners, she gets on the computer and Googles new leg. And she comes up with dozens of images of prosthetics, many of them mine. And she prints them out, goes to school, does show and tell on it, comes home, and makes a startling pronouncement to her parents. "I want to get rid of my bad leg," she says. "When can I get a new leg?" And ultimately, that was the decision her parents and doctors made for her. And so here she was, 6 months after the amputation, and right there in the middle of this street fair, she hikes up her jeans leg to show me her cool new leg. And it's pink, and it's tattooed with the characters of High School Musical 3. Replete with red sequined Mary Janes on her feet. And she was proud of it. She was proud of herself. And the marvelous thing was that this 6-year-old understood something that it took me 20-something years to get. But we did both discover that when we can celebrate and truly own what it is that makes us different, we're able to find the source of our greatest creative power. Thank you.
Hi again. Listening to the rundown of prosthetic leg creations just now reminds me of a pair I had designed, especially for the opening and closing ceremonies of the London 2012 Games, when I got to lead the U.S. Paralympic delegation into Olympic Stadium. The legs have a silicone skin-like covering with a metallic gold inlay of laurel leaves spanning the sides, an Olympic symbol of victory and honor since the time of the ancient Greeks. They are really something. If you'd like to see what they look like, I'll make a photo available at themoth.org/extras. Well, that's it for this episode. And from all of us here at The Moth, we hope that you have a wonderful, story-filled week. Hey, extra credit for those who are inspired to touch that Olympic spirit this week, whether that's to pretend you're Apollo Ono skating in your socks on your kitchen floor, or giving us your best Simone Biles with a cartwheel in your living room, or do like I did when I was little, try and do Greg Louganis flips onto the bed from the headboard. Actually, maybe skip that last one. Good luck.
Amy Mullins has built a storied career as an athlete, model, actor, and advocate for women, sports, and the next generation of prosthetics. She competed NCAA Division I as a champion sprinter and set three world records. In 1998, Amy made her runway debut in London at the invitation of Alexander McQueen, being a pioneer in challenging the notion of what disability means. As an actor, Amy received accolades for her debut in the art epic Cremaster 3 by Matthew Barney, and is now in the Netflix mega hit Stranger Things. Amy Mullins' story was directed by Sarah Austin Jeunesse. This episode of the Mouth Podcast was produced by Sarah Austin Jeunesse, Sarah Jane Johnson, and me, Mark Solinger. The rest of the Mouth leadership team includes Sarah Haberman, Christina Norman, Jennifer Hickson, Meg Bowles, Kate Tellers, Marina Gluce, Suzanne Rust, Brandon Grant Walker, Leanne Gully, and Aldi Kaza. The Moth would like to thank its supporters and listeners. Stories like these are made possible by community giving. If you're not already a member, please consider becoming one or making a one-time donation today at themoth.org/giveback. All Moth stories are true, as remembered by the storytellers. For more about our podcast, information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org. The Moth Podcast is presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, helping make public radio more public at prx.org.